I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the economic downturn is forcing many families to cut back, but how much should the kids know about all that? The Mocha Moms talk about that in a few minutes. But first, the McCain and Obama campaigns have found something to agree on, that the latest New Yorker magazine cover is tasteless and offensive. It's a caricature of a turban-clad Senator Barack Obama in the Oval Office sharing a fist bump with his wife, Michelle, who's sporting a huge afro, military fatigues, and an AK-47. Oh, and for good measure, a picture of Osama bin Laden hangs over a mantle, and the American flag burns in the fireplace. The cover has sparked discussion all over the blogosphere and the rest of the media. The question is, how far is too far when it comes to political satire? Here to talk about all of this, George Curry, former editor of Emerge magazine, a now defunct political magazine that is still remembered for its provocative covers, and Richard Prince, author of Journalism. It's an online publication about diversity in the news business. Welcome to you both. Thanks for stopping.
Thanks, Michelle.
Richard, I'm going to start with you. David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, spoke to our colleague Michelle Norris on All Things Considered yesterday. Here's what he had to say.
And I think the over-the-topness of all these images is also meant to push you and to make you laugh, a kind of maybe a nervous laugh or some kind of laugh at this image about how over-the-top it is, but also to think. Barry Blitt had something to say, who's the artist, and by me publishing it, I agree with him, that these are awful lies about the Obamas.
Richard, I take it a lot of people aren't laughing.
They certainly are not laughing. They're saying, what was the New Yorker thinking with this? It does make people think, it does make people comment, but not about what Remick intended. It makes people think about the New Yorker and what was on their minds. It undermines the whole purpose of satire, which is to focus in on a target and make you think about it. When you become the object of the conversation instead of what you're writing about or illustrating, it just doesn't work.
George, you are a former editor. As I said, you're currently a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, but you're also a former president of the American Society of Magazine Editors, so you have a lot of grounding in this. What's your take on the cover?
Well, I kind of have two standards. One is I don't think it's fair game for the spouse of a public official unless they happen to be Bill Clinton, which who can inspire a lot of cartoons on his own. The other part of it is, this is political satire. If you're a public official, then be prepared for it. So if you want to deal with Obama, yeah. Michelle, no. My first reaction when I saw the cartoon was, boy, when I saw the Muslim outfit and Obama's a Christian, I said, boy, that's trouble. Then I saw the AKA with Michelle, and I said, that's trouble. But I saw her with Afro. I said, oh, they've really lost it now. They don't know. You don't mess with sister's hair. And I knew that was going to be the one element that propelled this thing completely aboard everything.
Now I kind of have a fro, so I'm a little hurt by this. What are you saying, that it's not an acceptable hairstyle?
Look, I'm a stain. You know, when he calls the sisters nappy-headed hoes, you know, which is terrible within itself. Each one of my sisters had a perm, had spent a lot of money on that perm. And if anybody looked nappy hair, it was Imus. Mm-hmm. You know? And so sisters are funny about the hair. Most of them don't have natural, as you know. I have three sisters, Chris, Charlotte, and Sue. If I were to run something that was about hair, negative on Emerge when I was editor of Emerge, they would have led the boycott.
As I said, your magazine Emerge, which focused on politics and policy relevant to African Americans, it was published by BET. It was known for some provocative covers. You had one where Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was once depicted with a rag on his head, a so-called handkerchief head. Now, that's a reference which we would take some time to decode if you're not familiar with it. But another time he was depicted as a lawn jockey. Did you ever get this kind of outcry?
Sure,
was it more intense depending on who the subject was?
Well, first of all, mine was accurate. That was not satire. I mean, Clarence Thomas never met a civil rights law that he liked. So, you know, I was going for the juggler, of course. In this case, though, the first time we ran him with an Auntie Mama knot, which is based on Auntie Mama image of a subservient Negro who willingly accepts second-class status. And interestingly enough, the comments were split 50-50 because they didn't really understand who Clarence Thomas was. And the people, really, the way the thing came about, and this is what you have to understand about these crazy covers, you never know how they come up. And I was in a meeting with Flo Purnell, my managing editor. I said, what's the story about? And basically, they had gone to people who had supported Clarence in the past. And she said, well, they'll basically call him a handkerchief head. And I started laughing. She said, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. She said, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. And that's how we came up with the concept.
Richard, George said that the reaction to some of his more provocative covers, accurate or not, was a split 50-50.
The first time.
Is that what you're getting on your site?
I'm getting basically negative. And one of the differences between this Clarence Thomas cover and this one is, in the Clarence Thomas cover, it was very obvious who the target was. He was right there in the image. In the New Yorker cover, the target is supposed to be the people who are actually holding the magazine. And that's why it doesn't work. If they had perhaps had someone looking at this particular assemblage, a Karl Rove type, for example, people would get it, that this is a satire on Karl Rove. Now they're looking at it and they're saying, who's the target? There's no target. They're just making fun of Obama and Michelle.
But does anybody really think that the New Yorker magazine thinks that Obama is a Muslim with a secret passion for Osama bin Laden and that Michelle is a gun-toting revolutionary?
It doesn't make any difference whether they think that or not. First of all, magazine covers circulate far outside the intended audience. You see them as you pass on the newsstand. They can be cut, and somebody said, I can see this being cut up and pasted on the side of a pickup truck with a Confederate flag. I mean, non-New Yorker readers will see this, people in doctor's office, wherever. So they may not get it. And especially if it's so subtle that, as I said, that the intended target is not pictured.
You really think it's subtle, though?
Well, according to Remick, it's subtle because they're making fun of somebody who's not there.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with editor George Curry and writer Richard Prince about the latest cover of the New Yorker magazine that depicts Barack Obama as a Muslim and his wife Michelle as an angry revolutionary with a fro that she never has apparently worn. But George, what responsibility do you think media outlets should have when it comes to respecting the sensitivities of their audience? Of course, I'm thinking about the controversy over the Danish cartoons of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, and which sparked, you know, protests around the world, and the newspaper that originally published them and those that followed said that they were trying to make a point about free speech. But other people said, you know what, it's disrespectful when you're being gratuitously hurtful. Do you think that publishers have a responsibility to consider the sensitivities of their audience, especially given that with your magazine, there are people who didn't think that, they thought it was hurtful.
They thought it was hurtful. Then the second round, which is why I said they were split the first time. The first time, the second round, I got 90% support. And you were too light on Clarence Thomas when we ran him as a lawn jockey. You look, as an editor, you take bold stance with cover. If you're a small magazine like I was, with The Merge, how else are you going to get the word out there? You want people talking about your magazines. And I think this is what people have to understand about magazines is like, yeah, I agree with Dick. They tried it. They missed a point. It was not effective. But do they have a right to do it? Absolutely. Political satire? Absolutely. And do they have a right to fail? They have an absolute right to do that. But you make the stand.
You think it fails? You don't think it fails? You don't think it succeeds as satire?
The fact that it puts on the politics of fear, head to heading, and all the other things, I don't think it's that effectively. I don't think it's that effective. Obviously, we have this kind of discussion as well.
You think it matters that the New Yorker magazine is a, I don't know how else to put it this way, a white magazine? It's published mainly by white people whose audience is mainly white, and that it's perceived as kind of an outsider taking on a, even though Barack Obama's and his wife are clearly mainstream public figures at this point. Do you think that matters, whereas it emerges as an African-American-oriented publication critiquing an African-American in terms that are familiar to African-Americans? Do you think that makes a difference? I'd like to ask both of you, Richard.
It makes some difference, but that's not the main difference. Because first of all, they're not critiquing Obama and Michelle. They're critiquing the audience. And the other point is that it's the New Yorker magazine. It's not Mad Magazine. If this were Mad Magazine, or they had an old publication called The Realist, which was known for this kind of thing, for being outrageous, people would look at it and say, aha, there they go again. That's them. The New Yorker doesn't usually do this. So that's what makes a difference. So then people are free to interpret the New Yorker's motives in any way they want.
But remember, about 15 years ago, they had another cover that got a lot of attention. It was a Valentine's Day cover, a Hasidic Jew kissing a black woman at a time when there was a lot of tension between these two communities in New York. Isn't it the same thing, or is it not the same thing?
No.
Let's not get away from the idea. The idea is to be provocative. Mm-hmm. It's not to get pats on the back, obviously. You're most likely to get kicks in the behind. And that's a chance you take. You take a chance if you're editor of a magazine and say, I'm going to be provocative. I'm going to get people's attention. Everybody's not going to agree, but that's the whole idea in the first
place. But isn't that, by that standard, hasn't it succeeded? We're talking about it.
Well, if that's your yardstick on that one, yes, I would say so. But in terms of really talking about the people who lie about Barack Obama's image, or lying about Michelle's image, that discussion is not all that active around it.
Yeah, they've got some very serious pieces inside the publication one that runs like 18 pages. No one is talking about that. I mean, all they're talking about is they're talking about boycotts and that kind of thing.
So do you think that this is a one-day story, partly because it's summer and there's a little bit of a lull in the campaign, or do you think this is the kind of thing that is – I guess what I'm asking is this the story or is this reflective of some other story, George?
No, this will be a story anytime, any month, you name it. This will be a story. Like I said, the problem I have with it is that the Michelle is included in it. I don't think that's fair game. I think Barack, if you want to do it, he's a public figure, fair game. The spouses, unless you're Bill Clinton, keep him out of it.
Even though the Muslim garb is meant to is in direct contradiction of a point that he's trying to make.
Absolutely,
still think
but
it's fair.
He's a public figure. If once you're a public figure, black, white, or polka dot, be prepared. Mm-hmm. But she's not entitled to that.
Richard, final thought.
Well, I think that it's part of a continuing narrative of the campaign. Whether it will last a couple of more days depends on what else happens. I know Jesse Jackson, for example, is very happy this happened.
Taking his faux pas right. off the pages and off of our discussion points. Richard Prince is author of Journalism. That's an online publication about diversity issues in the news business. And George Curry, former editor of Emerge magazine, a former president of the American Society of Magazine Editors. He's currently a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. They were both kind enough to join me in our Washington studio. Gentlemen, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, working with debt collectors, how to stop the craziness, and our monthly visit with our ethics panel. But first, they say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few mocha moms. We visit with members of this mother support group each week for their common sense and savvy parenting advice. Today, we want to talk about preparing your children to face tough economic times. Job loss, divorce, death of a spouse, a medical crisis, all these can disrupt a family's finances. And with home foreclosures and other bad economic news in the headlines, we thought it was a good time to talk about how to survive a financial crisis without traumatizing the kids. Here to talk about this are the Mocha Moms, Jolene Ivey, Danette Tucker, and Donna Maria Coles Johnson. Welcome, ladies, moms.
Hey, Michelle. Thank you.
Now, Donna Maria, you visited with us a while back to talk about how to make the most of coupons. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason you're such an expert. So can you just refresh our memories about that?
Sure, Michelle. 3 years ago, my husband lost a job to a layoff. The result was a 60% drop in our income in one day. And so I quickly had to rein our finances in, which I'd never really done before. We had a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old at the time. So it was quite a devastating loss, but through it, we have learned to be better money managers. So the silver lining is that we have a lot more money savvy to show for our experience.
Oh, that's great. Danny, what about you? Have you ever had a setback that you had to explain to the kids?
Oh, yeah, big setback. My ex-husband, their father, and I separated and subsequently divorced. We were in Maryland, and I had lost my job because I had to have another surgery. And had to go in the system, had to go on welfare. I had to move my kids out of Maryland into D.C. because D.C. had more programs than Maryland had to help single moms. You know, I went from 2 salaries to nothing and went on the system, went down there and signed up for what is called TANF now. It's not called welfare, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. I used it for 2 years to get back on my feet, took advantage of all the programs that it had, took some classes. They helped me with job searching. The kids were able to do a lot of free things because of it. Youth programs, sporting programs. And, you know, I mean, I didn't feel bad about it, but I had to use the system to get back on my feet, and I did.
Okay, I want to come back to you on that. Jolene, what about you? Have you ever had to retrench?
Well, we knew we were going to have to retrench, and that's what my husband had been partner at a law firm, and he was making, you know, a lot of money for most people and certainly for us. And when he was running for public office and it looked like he was going to win, I said, oh, my God, if this man wins this thing, our salary gets cut in half. Mm-hmm. And it was a serious hit. So since we kind of planned for it, it wasn't as bad. We used to have 2 people cleaning our house. And over the course of the months leading up to him winning, we have, well, now we have 7 people cleaning our house, my 5 kids and me and my husband, you know, that kind of thing. We no cable. I mean, we had to cut to the bone because that's how it was.
But do you think it made it easier because it was your choice? Or was there a part of you that was mad?
No, it was easier because it was our choice. Definitely. It wasn't like devastating or anything like that. It was certainly nothing like Danny's gone through. What it was, though, was harder for the kids. I guess they don't really care whether it's your choice or not. They just know they don't have cable. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. How did you explain it to the kids? I want to go around and ask each of you that question. Jolene, I'm going to start with you because we were talking to you. You and Glenn made a decision that he was going to make a change, that he was going to do something he believed in that was important to do, but it had a big impact on them. How did you explain it?
Well, we try to show them all the time that what's important is that you love your job and you do something that you want to do and that you feel makes a difference. And sometimes that means you don't make as much money as you possibly could. And we try to make it so that things aren't the most important thing in our lives.
Danny, what about you? It seems to me that you had a lot of changes. The kids obviously knew some of this was going on, but how did you talk to them about it? And how did you keep them from being devastated?
I hate to coin the phrase, but I kept it real. I had to. It was not the time to make up anything. I mean, they're living in it. I didn't want them to hear it from anybody else. I sat them down, said, this is what's happening. A, B, C, D, and this is what we're going to have to do. But I took an opportunity to teach them a life lesson. Life will do that sometimes. It may throw you a curveball out of nowhere. And you got to be able to just revamp yourself. And the biggest thing we did was not stay bitter. Would not let them get bitter. And I felt that telling them the truth about what was going on kept them from being bitter.
Were they ever angry at you? Because sometimes when there's a parent missing, the parent who's still there is the one that comes in for the drama. Because you're the safe one, right?
Oh, so, yeah. Very mad at me. Why won't you stick in there with Daddy? They didn't understand that Daddy is not a good influence here right now. So I had to do what was best for them. And at the time, it was not best to stay in that.
How did you master your own emotions? Because you obviously had your own feelings of, you had to, of being vulnerable, of being frightened, of
faith and my Verizon's friends and family network. I used my Verizon family and friends network beyond telephone calls. You know what I mean? I mean, they would come over and go, all right, girl, come on, let's do this. And I got the spaghetti tonight. All right, well, I'll go watch a movie with the kids. It was that, you know, the village reached out and came to me. And when I saw them there with me and we're all doing the same thing, it just lifts you to another place and you feel like you can just go on. And that's what we did.
Donna Maria, what about you? Your kids were so little at the time, but I think having little kids makes you feel very vulnerable. You know what I mean? And so how did you think about what to talk about with them or how to deal with the situation vis-a-vis them? What did you do?
At the time, they were too young. I mean, one was an infant practically and the other one was just beginning to walk. So I think what we went through was right after the layoff, we had to regroup. And ultimately, 2.5, 3 years later, we sold our house and moved 600 miles away. That was when we had some explaining to do. Because by then, they were old enough to have a couple of friends. They'd been to some birthday parties, and they wanted an explanation as to why they were leaving their grandma and their grandpa and all their friends and the people that they had gotten to know. So we did have to sit down and talk with them. And as my fellow Mocha Mom said, keep it real. You know, this is what Mommy and Daddy have to do so that we can take care of ourselves and plan for our future and plan for your future as well.
When you have to retrench abruptly as you did, you didn't have time to plan, I assume. You didn't see it coming. What's the first, second, and third thing you did?
Well, we prayed a lot. Secondly, we just cut off a lot of things that we wanted but didn't need. We turned off the cable. We stopped using the utilities as much as we did. We used one vehicle. We bought gas at a cheaper place, and I really spent a lot of time encouraging my husband at that time in addition to regrouping our finances.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with the Mocha Moms, Jolene Ivey, Danette Tucker, Donna Maria Coles-Johnson, about teaching your kids to deal with tough economic times. Donna Maria, you're also really big on teaching your kids about money, and not just the difference between cash and credit and my favorite is you sometimes pay their preschool bill in cash.
Yeah.
Why do you emphasize that so much?
Because I want them to see the money leaving our house and going into something that's important. My daughter once actually, not just last year, she told my son, my six-year-old daughter told my son, you know, you really have to do your best in school because mommy pays a lot of money for this. And that's because every now and then I call the school in advance to make sure it's okay to bring cash, but I would bring cash and tell them this, we're going to go into the office today and we're going to pay for your school. So they could understand the connection between getting something of value and the fact that it costs money instead of swiping the credit card or writing a check. So I want them to know it's money coming out of the, you know, pizza budget or the toy, the Spider-Man budget in my son's case.
Danny, how do you talk to your kids about money? Because on the one hand, you want them to respect the hard work. On the other hand, you don't want them to be obsessed with money because, you know, you can see where it could go the other way. If kids see their parents struggling so hard, they make it becomes so important that they can't learn the lesson Jolene was talking about, that money isn't everything. It becomes everything. How do you balance that?
I put them to work. The best way for them to know what I'm going through, you go through it. You know, where I make, you know, you're going to babysit, you're going to clean this, you're going to go over to so-and-so's house and do this. And my son's working his second summer job at the summer youth program. I don't want them to be naive to what this world is about if something like this happens. You got to work your way back from it. So come on and work.
Jolene, what about you?
I actually worry about my kids worrying about money. I worry about my oldest kid who's in college now, and he worries about how much this is costing us. And he worries about, does it make sense for him when he finishes college to go on to law school? And I tell him, look, whatever you'd have to take out in loans, in the long run, it's going to be worth it to get whatever education you need. And it's not just for how much money you can make, but the choices, the freedom that you have because you have enough education to do whatever you want to do.
I wanted to ask each of you, because as we all know, kids can be very mean, particularly as they get to a certain age, and then what you wear, what you drive, where you hang out becomes a big deal. I remember when I was, I must have been in junior high school. I remember going to the bus stop every day and having this one girl, I can't remember her name, I must have blocked it out, basically itemize what everybody at the bus stop had on, particularly by label. And if there was not a label, then she'd be like, Like, for some reason, I remember Fred Braun shoes. Well, she got some Fred Braun shoes and some Guess jeans. And just, you know, you would just want to die, you know? You could say, oh, you should be tougher than that, bigger than that. But, you know, at that age, right? So how do you, Danny, I wanted to ask you, especially when you went into the on the system, as you said, and started getting relief, Tana. Was that hard for the kids?
It was at first, but one thing that I learned from family back then is we never really focused on Guess jeans and, you know, buying a lot of designers and spend our money on that. So I was thankful to my parents for instilling that in me because that helped us do the kids that way, period. You know, so we can stay trendy without paying $200 for some Michael Jordans. Jordan don't need your money. You know, so my son now, you know, I like that. The kids now coming up with their own styles. They're going into the styles that, like Stephon Marbury, whose shoes are very inexpensive. But, okay, you know, they're getting into that. So I just kind of, you know, promote that with them. Promote the alternative. You know, it's cooler now to do this than to pay all this money and have these things and then act like a fool and not appreciate them, you know?
Jolene, what about you?
Well, in our house, we generally think people are crazy if they spend $200 on a pair of tennis shoes. So we don't really have that kind of thing to worry about. My poor kids, I really kind of felt sorry for them because for years, I mean, I so much don't care about clothes that the neighbors would just drop off bags of clothes. And we would just go through the bags and whatever you wanted, we'd use. And whatever you don't want, I'd give it to Goodwill. And I didn't think about it for a long time that that's how we clothed, you know, all the kids and even me sometimes because I just don't care. But when they figured out that their friends' clothes was what they were wearing, then they started to become annoyed. And they said, no more. We will not wear any more clothes like this. So, you know, they don't even care if I go to Goodwill and buy the item. They just want to have the chance to pick it out and it not be something that their kid, you know, friend around the corner dropped off.
Which is funny because now that's a cool thing among adults is to have like a swap meet on the weekends. This is
adults
are doing that.
That's what I mean, making it cool.
Yeah, in fact, Danny, you got a sweater that I'm looking at that I'm kind of wanting to
thank
ask
my mama.
If you.
Thank mama. I got it in the swap bag.
Donna Maria, what about you? Give us some of your other tips for teaching kids about money and helping them to kind of work through these issues without being scarred by it.
Well, one of the things I do is I coupon a lot. I have a special little section in my coupon notebook for snacks and treats for my children. And we go to the grocery store. If they can find a coupon for it, then they can buy it. So when we get up to the cash register, I try to find one that's empty, and I give them the money. They're only 4 and 6, so they, you know, they're not old enough to understand a lot of the things about designer clothing and things of that nature. But I give them the money, and I let them, you know, actually feel the money going through their fingers and, you know, pay for it and see what the receipt says and see how much money they saved using that coupon. That box of whatever it is that they got cost $1.50 less because they used a coupon. And that's really an effective tool to show them because you can see it on the receipt. You can trace it all the way through from the coupon to the receipt.
And you're big on letting the kids see you pay bills. You're saying a lot of times mm-hmm. kids will see their parents go to the ATM, take money mm-hmm. out, or they'll see their mm-hmm. kid, but they don't see their parents paying bills because that's something that the parents want to do when it's quiet. So what do you, how do you do with that? Especially because a lot of people pay bills online. You just have them sit with you and say, watch
yeah,
me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I let them sit with me and watch. And, you know, with automatic deposits and stuff from jobs and things like that, it is tough. But it has been worth it to take them to the bank and show them the money, even when they get a gift in cash or if we have some money that's come in from wherever we get it from, just to make the point to show them we're not just driving through the ATM machine pulling money out. We got to go into the bank and put money in there first before you can get some out. So the work, as the Mocha sisters say, comes before the reward.
Okay. Danny? Final thought from you, some other tips?
Use your Verizon and family and friends network for other than phone calls, really. I mean, just take that idea and run with it. We share cooking. We share homework help. You don't need a tutor. I can do that. You know, the kids are doing it now. So-and-so got an iPod. We done swapped this day. We use our network for a lot more than just sharing minutes.
But do you ever, but I have to ask, though, have your kids ever been teased? And how do you
Yeah, they
deal
have
with
been.
It?
But that's when you go. I always, when they come home, I'm the motivator in the house. And we do the old-fashioned sticks and stones may break my bones, but words don't hurt me. You know, I'm like, that's just words, y'all. Can't let it stop you. We're going to keep going the way we're going, and you make it look good. Make your character make it look good. And they do. They get teased. They get frustrated, especially Davon, because he's
a 15-year-old.
And he wants to be cool, but it has made him work harder.
Jolene, final thought from you?
Well, if I can put on my legislator's hat just for a second, there's a couple of bills that we passed in Maryland this year that might have some impact on the rest of the country, if depending on how it's taken up. One is credit card companies. They can't come on campus anymore and just ply their wares without anything that else. They have to also provide education and materials about what happens to credit card debt so that kids don't just get these credit cards, run them up like crazy while they're in college, probably making little to no money, and then they graduate not just with huge student loans, but huge credit card debt. So that's one thing. And another is in Maryland, we have a task force now to study how to improve financial literacy in the state. And they're going to start with high school kids on up and look at how much do kids know, how much do people know, and where do we need to improve. So after we have the information, we'll be able to take better action. Because we did find out in 2006, there were 65% of high school seniors with failing scores with knowing how money works. And that's just like ridiculous. That's an increase over 44% of just a couple of years ago. So things are really gotten bad with young people understanding money. And Donna Maria, you need to come back up here and help us out.
I'd love to.
There's one other thing that Donna Maria, we don't have time to talk about, but I also want to mention that you also emphasize the importance of giving. That when you talk mm-hmm. to kids about money, you talk about saving, spending, and investing, but you do also make a point of talking about donating. So I think that's point. And as I mentioned, we will have all of your tips on our website. So our regular Mocha Moms, Jolene Ivey, Danny Tucker, they joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. We're also joined by Donna Maria Coles Johnson, a Mocha Mom expatriate, I guess, in Charlotte, North Carolina. She joined us from WFAE in Charlotte. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, our monthly visit with the O Magazine Ethics Panel on why the best thing to say is sometimes nothing. But first, we're continuing Cheapskate Week on Tell Me More, where we're looking at how we can all save a buck or two. Today, debt collectors. You come home, look at that flashing answering machine light, and you know that the caller ID is not showing the number for a friend. You're getting calls from debt collectors. Intimidating, frustrating, embarrassing for most people. Debt collectors can make you feel like a prisoner in your own private hell. But our financial expert, Alvin Hall, tells us it doesn't have to be that way. He's going to tell us how to get some sanity and stop the madness. Welcome, Alvin. Thanks for talking to us.
I'm glad to talk about this because I want people to know that they are not alone, that the government is actually in some ways on their side.
Well, first of all, let's just talk about who are debt collectors. Is there one company or agency that does this? And at what point do they get involved in calling people?
A debt collector is an agency. It can also be an attorney who is responsible for bringing in the debts of people who have defaulted on them. The company from whom you've gotten your credit card or taken a loan calls up this company and said, I have a deadbeat here. Get my money. And so they start sometimes calling you up daily in order to get that money. And this always happens after somebody has defaulted on the loan and not returned the phone calls of the primary lender, be that a credit card or a bank.
What's considered a default? Is there some trigger for a default, or does it change? Does it vary depending on who the lender is?
Generally, when you hit the 90 days late mark, you're in default. Some credit card issuers or lenders will let you go a little bit longer, but if you don't start returning their phone calls, if you don't start negotiating in good faith and putting into place a plan that you can actually adhere to, they will turn you over to a debt collector just like that.
Are there any guidelines for how debt collectors have to behave?
Yes. There's an act called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act that really lays out clearly what debt collectors can and cannot do. For example, they cannot call you before 8 a.m. or after 9 p.m. They cannot call your employer if your employer hates certain phone calls. And people don't know you can actually stop them from calling you. If you write a letter to the debt collector saying that you wish not to be contacted by them any longer, they must stop doing that. That does not mean that the debt goes away. All you're doing really maybe is putting your head in the sand, but you can stop them from calling you.
How could it possibly be that simple?
Because
first of all, how do you know who you're writing to?
When they call you, you ask for an address and a phone number. Generally, if you're really firm about that, they will give that to you. You then send it in writing. If you want to negotiate in good faith and come up with a plan that you can adhere to, put it in writing and state the terms of it. You have much more control over the situation than many people imagine.
So what you're saying is get control of the situation. And if you are intimidated, if you are afraid, write it down. Say, I have a good faith intention to work this out.
Yes.
And maybe you feel more control when you write it down.
Exactly. By the time you've gotten to a debt collector, this means that the primary lender has lost faith in your ability to keep your promises. So I tell everybody, try not to let it get to that point. When you're negotiating with your lenders, come up with amounts that you know you can afford. Important, keep your promises. If you say, I'm going to make a payment on this date, make a payment on this date. And interestingly, debt collectors are prohibited from depositing checks that are predated or postdated checks. They're prohibited from depositing them early. So if you say, I'm going to make a payment on this date, and you send them the check, they must hold that check to that date.
Is there any way to restructure debt without going through a bankruptcy proceeding or without going to court?
There is, but you have to be really strong. When debts reach a certain level beyond $50,000, $100,000, you might as well just look at the courts for remedy. You can try, but you then have to take control of every aspect of your debt. You have to arrange it from highest interest rate to lowest interest rate. You have to put in a schedule of payments for when you're going to pay them off. And I think it's really important psychologically to give yourself an end date. Say, I plan to pay this off in the next 3 years. However, if you've lost your job, you've had medical emergencies, and there's just no way you can get money, then you just have to be blunt with people and say, if you push any further, you're forcing me, in essence, into bankruptcy. And then they'll get nothing.
I want to switch gears now to another story that's in the news. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and no, we are not talking about your country cousins.
You know? North Carolina cousins.
North Carolina cousins. What are those two entities, and what happened over the weekend that's so important?
These two entities were set up to give banks more money to make mortgage loans. These organizations would go around, look at the portfolio of loans that banks around the country made, buy up those loans from those banks,
thus giving those banks more money to make more loans. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would then package those loans into pools of loans and then sell certificates or bonds to institutions backed by that pool of mortgages. What happened was they held a number of those mortgages on their own books, and those mortgages began to default. Wall Street and some of the investors, especially the aggressive investors, saw this as a lame rabbit just limping toward the grave, and they decided to just jump on this, and they sold short those shares and drove them way, way down. And it seemed as if these two institutions, which are critical to the American housing market, were going to go under. Over the weekend, Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, and other financial leaders got together and came up with a way to provide Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae access to more money. Therefore, their financial situation now looks more stable.
Crisis over or not?
No, I don't think the crisis is over. There's one really important factor in all of this. The names of these organizations are the Federal National Mortgage Association and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation. With the word federal in front of it, and it seemed to imply to the public that these were government-backed organizations. In reality, the securities that they issued were backed by the full faith and credit of only the organization itself, not the government. So the government has now stepped in and given it much more of a feeling of government backing, government guarantee. But the crisis is not over, because you now have the regional banks all around the country. You have Indy Bank, which went under, and we saw people trying to get their money out of that bank. This does not make the average person feel comfortable with the banking system, especially if there are rumors out there that 30 or more banks could possibly go under.
If you have a mortgage that's backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, is there something you should be concerned about?
Not really. You can still make your mortgage payment on time. They will still hold your mortgage if they have not pooled it together and sold it to somewhere else. Your mortgage will still be safe. So that's not your worry. The worry is, will they be able to make more mortgages, and will they be able to service the pools of mortgages that they put together if they really stumble financially?
Some grim news ahead, huh?
Well, we live in difficult times. What's so dark about this period to me is that it's going at the heart of what Americans cherish, your home. So we all bought the dream. We worked hard to get on the property ladder. And many people were sold mortgages that they could not afford. At least in working out this new plan, the government is saying, if you take out a mortgage starting in December 2009, the lender must make sure you can afford the mortgage. The question is, why didn't somebody think about this earlier? And the answer is, there was too much profit on the table for people to care.
Mm. Alvin Hall, our financial expert, joined us from our bureau in New York. Alvin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Do you ever find yourself tongue-tied when somebody asks you something that is just none of their business, or expresses regret for something that, frankly, is not a problem? Those are just some of the questions our intrepid ethics advisors tackle in this month's Now What Do I Do? Column in O, the Oprah Magazine. We check in on the column each month to get ideas for tackling everyday ethical questions. Joining us now is O Magazine columnist Jancy Dunn. She edits the Now What Do I Do? Column. Also with us is Faith Saley, a member of the O Magazine Ethics Panel and the host of the Public Radio International program Fair Game. Welcome back, ladies, both of you.
Thanks, Michelle. Let's tackle things.
Okay. Jancy, there's some good questions this month. We're going to start with two that involve saying the wrong thing to mothers. First, we have a new mom who's 41, just had her fourth child, and people feel, for whatever reason, that they can say some incredibly rude things to her, like, so was he an accident? Or, guess you haven't figured out how this happens. Oh, my goodness. So how did the panel advise her to respond?
They advised a few different approaches. Anita Allen said, pregnant women and new mothers bring out the stupid in us all, and often people don't know what to say. So just brush it off with a, you know, it's wonderful having a large family type of comment. And then two other panelists, Jack Marshall and Rudy Rasmus, said to just smile and don't say a word. And that sort of highlights the fact that the person said something really rude. As Rudy said, never argue with a fool. People looking on won't know which one is the fool. So just smile at him and say nothing.
But Jancy, you said something. You pointed out something interesting. In fact, I think Anita also said this in her response, which is something about pregnancy and new mothers just makes people feel that they can just come out of their mouth. Why do you think that is? Do you get a lot of questions from pregnant moms, new moms, saying, you know, why did somebody say this to me? What's going on with this?
We get a ton of those sorts of questions. I mean, for whatever reason, it just seems to dissolve any sort of healthy boundaries between people. We get everything from pregnant women who have people touching their pregnant bellies, oh, you know, grabbing them and squeezing them. And, and then, I know. And then these sorts of questions, and even people with young children who've been adopted, people ask all sorts of thoughtless things. I don't know if they feel like it's kind of this universal human condition so they can chime in with anything or what.
This is Faith. I think it takes a village to insult people. Maybe that's what they think.
Well, Faith, next question to you. The next question is also about saying something off to a mother. Your letter writer spoke to a woman at a party who mentioned that her son had autism, and your reader told this woman, I'm sorry. The mother was offended. She said there's nothing to be sorry about. Faith, what was your response to this?
Well, first of all, this woman had the best intentions, to be sure. But the lesson learned here is, you know, if you bite your tongue when a virtual stranger reveals something personal to you, you can't go wrong. You know, if you sort of have that all-purpose furrow brow, I'm really listening to you look, then you can't make any mistakes there. I mean, that's kind of a glib way of putting it. But what it's really about is being present as a listener and not feeling like you need to fill in the blanks. I think people's responses to us are often more about their own stories. You know, you tell someone you're getting a divorce and they say, gosh, I hope you don't feel like a failure. And you're like, wow, that never occurred to me. Or you tell someone your in-laws are coming. They're like, oh, my God. And you say, well, I really like my in-laws. So as listeners, we should be present for the other person and not insert our own mental narrative into our responses.
Jancy, what did the other panelists have to say?
Well, you know, they all agreed that the reader's intention was kind and that she didn't mean any harm. Jack Marshall in particular thought that I'm sorry is a perfectly acceptable response. But the other ones agreed with Faith in that you don't necessarily have to add your own commentary. You can ask a question. Rudy Rasmus, for instance, said, simply ask, how is he doing?
That makes sense. I see what you're saying because I'm thinking of a number of circumstances where this might apply. Let's say that you have a neighbor or a friend whom you do not know very well who reveals that her teenager is having a baby. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it could be, the response could be, how wonderful. It could be, are you okay? It could be, you know what I mean? You don't know what that circumstance represents, right? What that information represents to that person. It could be that your friend or whatever was, or acquaintance was relieved that this person made a positive choice in her view. You know what I mean? There's all kinds of responses. I see your point about that you don't want to bring your stuff to it.
This is Jancy. Switch over into a neutral question. Oh, when does she do?
Faith, there's another gender-related question in this month's column that has nothing to do with being a mom. A woman wrote in to say she was having trouble in her new job, which involved supervising men in a sales office. She said she was getting a chilly response, whether she was kind of tough, straightforward, or soft. She was kind of worried about being considered, well, you know, the B word. What is your answer to this? You were kind of hardcore.
I gotta say, Michelle, I was really surprised at the very nature of this question. I mean, it seems like concern about being considered the B word at work is a problem from 1988. It sounds to me like this poor woman is buried under the weight of her self-consciousness and her shoulder pads. She needs to fling them both off and be herself.
I don't know, though. Jancy, help me out here. I've heard a number of women grapple with this question. What did the rest of the panel have to say?
Oh, I have too. And in terms of questions about the workplace, this is the absolute number one question, which surprised me.
I'm shocked.
Yes. But it does come up an awful lot. And most of the panelists said it's better to be respected than liked, and the best person to be is your authentic self. Rudy Rasmus suggested maybe hiring a coach to help sharpen your management style. And Anita Allen said, how about reading some books on management theory and studying the biographies of powerful, successful women? But it is something that, you know, you could argue that women are a little more intuitive when it comes to their coworkers, and they tend to be more concerned about what people think. I mean, that's a blanket statement, but it's what I hear from a lot of the readers.
Finally, there's a pet lover's question in this month's issue. A woman wanted to know why she can't bring her dog into a bakery. And we're talking about a little dog, presumably a cute little dog. Faith?
That's me growling, yes.
Bring it on, Faith.
I hate this woman. I'm sorry. She's the same woman who brings 15 items in the 12 items or less lane. She's the woman who thinks it's okay if she talks on her cell phone on the treadmill at the gym. Look, the only type of critter that should be allowed in an eating establishment is one that helps you see. And her dog is not helping her see that she's being annoying and inconsiderate. You know, this. What's really behind this is entitlement. And this is when people think they're special and rules don't apply to them. And you know what? Everybody's special. Ask your mom and Jesus. Everybody's special.
Jancy, let me recover here. But Jancy, this leads to a question which I often ask, which is, why is this an ethical question as opposed to a question of etiquette?
Well, I think that when it comes down to an ethical question is in that moment that you decide to act, that you decide to confront someone or not, that you decide to live and let live or not. And in this case, you know, this dog owner is not being empathetic and thinking of what this restaurant owner goes through and how, you know, with this rise of people that carry their little dogs around, this must happen to the owner 1,000 times a day. I mean, I go to these kinds of establishments all the time, and there's always some little critter peeking out of someone's purse. And when you have your own needs that kind of supersede everyone else's, that's when you've made some sort of decision. And that's, I think, where the ethical debate lies.
Jancy Dunn writes the ethics column, Now What Do I Do, for O, the Oprah magazine. And Faith Saley is a member of the O magazine ethics panel. They both joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you both.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Baby back, dressed in black, silver buttons all down her back. Hello, tipsy toe. She broke a needle and she can't so walk in the dark.